Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Matt. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. My name is Matthew Iglesias. I'm a fellow at the Center for American Progress and Center for American Progress Action Fund. And you are?
I am Stephen Spruill. I'm a staff writer for National Review Magazine and National Review Online.
All right. And this is your Blogging Heads debut.
This is my debut on Blogging Heads.
It's very exciting. You lack dialogue experience,
I do.
much as Alana Kagan has no prior judicial experience.
That was a nice segue, a nice
Exactly.
segue. That
That's
is the
the savvy veteran move.
right. That's the knock on her from I mean I am look, I think that Republicans have very little ability to block Alana Kagan. I don't think they can, and I don't think they necessarily should, although I think Republicans can probably feel comfortable voting against her, Republican senators, that is. I'm more interested than anything that the right has to say about this debate that's going on among progressives, where you have Glenn Greenwald, who I think you could characterize as vehemently opposed to the Kagan nomination, versus others who say, well, this is not a bad pick. It's a very politically easy pick to make, perhaps, and that on this case, we're going to get a young and solidly progressive justice. Do you feel that's true?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of two axes of conflict among progressives about Kagan, right? And one, which I think is where Glenn Greenwald really started on this, is just between people who are, real sort of deep civil libertarians feel that Kagan is not one of them, and that, Kagan is a very appears to have, through her career, be a sort of very conventional, orthodox member of the Democratic Party, veteran of the Clinton administration, worked in the Obama administration, seems well liked by all the leaders there, and, should be, I think, a conventionally liberal justice. But civil libertarians were not thrilled with the policies of the Clinton administration, aren't thrilled with the policies of the Obama administration, and so have some reason to think they will not be thrilled with the rulings of a Justice Kagan. The other thing you see is just some people on the left, particularly people on the left who are also law professors, just sort of wish that you could have a judicial nominee who was someone maybe who had written more law review articles that were somehow really awesome. There's a kind of yearning, I think, among progressive lawyers, although not normal people, for some kind of a lion figure on the court, who writes in a really public but sophisticated and dynamic way about, why we're right and conservatives are wrong, and some kind of sense that the right has kind of owned these issues as a sort of,
Like a Scalia of the left, kind of.
yeah, something like that. Someone who will be their leader and who I think Dahlia Lithwick wrote about the idea that there should be someone who, liberal law students can look up to on the court. Personally, I'm not, all that invested in this. What I think is always interesting about fights is, we started saying that, the knock on Kagan from the right is that, well, she doesn't have the right kind of experience or something. But obviously, like, the real knock on Kagan from the right is just that Barack Obama appointed her, and presumably Barack Obama is going to appoint someone who conservatives don't like, and vice versa. And you see this, I think you saw it when Bush was appointing justices, and you see it when Obama is appointing justices, that there's some kind of problem in American political culture where senators can't just say, I think this person is like from the other side, and so I'm not going to give them my thumbs up and my stamp of approval. And instead, there's this like casting about to find, some other complaint to have with them.
Right. Well, look, I mean, I think that the precedent was established during the Bork nomination that the new standard for whether or not you can feel comfortable voting against a nominee is whether or not their judicial philosophy matches up with yours. It's no longer just, is this person qualified? And if so, then it's the president's choice and I will give my assent.
Right.
It's that this person has a very different philosophy of interpreting the Constitution than I do, and I'm going to vote against this person. I think the new standard is not do I vote against this person or do I vote for them? Does this nominee reach the level of do I disagree with this person so much that it's worth bringing the Republican conference together and blocking this person's nomination with
right.
a filibuster,
right.
right? And so I think with both Sotomayor and with Kagan, you're not going to see that level of vehement opposition among Republicans. They're not going to filibuster this nominee. And so I mean, just to say that Republicans oppose this person because Obama nominated her. I mean, that's probably true, but Obama nominated her because she shares his judicial philosophy, and it's one that Republicans reject.
Oh no, sure. I just meant that the inference is quite simple, right? I mean,
right.
There's not really some complicated process of reasoning you need to do. It's people figure that Obama has probably picked someone who agrees with Obama, and so people
right.
who don't agree with Obama probably, figure they don't like her.
Right.
But, the problem with this process is that I think we've seen with a lot of the procedural aspects of government that there's kind of a ratchet, right? I mean, there's never been a really serious effort to use 40 votes to block a Supreme Court nominee. And so for now, the bar for doing that is quite high. Right, and mm-hmm. and you're not seeing like a serious effort to just round up all 41 Senate Republicans, but presumably at some point someone is going to do that. 44 senators or whatever is going to block a Supreme Court appointment. At which point there'll be like a whole new precedent. It'll be a sort of a question. Almost of revenge or of tit for tat or just of having set a new standard. And then we're going to reach a situation where it's extremely difficult to fill these seats at all.
Yeah, you mentioned revenge and tit for tat. I think that was definitely in play once the Bork precedent was set. I know that it was something that lingered in the memory of the conservative movement that was talked about for a long time. So that when when Clarence Thomas came along, there was definitely a determination to not let that happen again.
Right. Well,
but I wonder, is there in your view a nominee that would have triggered that this time? Do you think that some of the names that were put forward by progressives is somebody they really wanted to see, like a Diane Wood or somebody like that, would have triggered that opposition in Republicans?
I don't see any particular reason to think that Diane Wood would have. Would have. I mean, as best I could tell, the differences in the record between her and Kagan were really not that large. I'm sure there's someone you can find out there. I mean, obviously, part of the purpose of the sort of the really hard time that Goodwin Liu is getting from minority members of the Judiciary Committee, right, is a kind of like a warning shot that Republicans. Really don't like this guy, and if Obama puts enough emphasis on it and twists enough arms, I think he can get Goodwin Liu confirmed to the Ninth Circuit. Given just the realities of the math, but
it's just how much political damage do Democrats sustain in the process? Does it
well,
bring
and,
up
and
issues
it's a,
that they're not really comfortable talking about?
And it's a signal that if you were to get this guy as a young 40s circuit court justice, and then try 10 years later to fill some vacancy with him, that that would be like a true fight to the death.
Right.
And, of course, I mean, we saw similar things when Bush was president. And I mean, just in terms of the tit for tat, right, I mean, you had a at least as far back as I know it, in the last couple years of the Clinton administration, it became extremely difficult to impossible to get any circuit court nominees through that the Judiciary Committee just kind of wouldn't bring people to the floor. So then when Bush was president, Democrats used the ability, even though they were in the minority, sort of took revenge and started using filibuster threats to block judicial confirmations, which hadn't been done before, was the result of a big standoff, but has resulted in a sort of an escalation, right? I mean, we walked away from the nuclear option, quote unquote. But there's just more vacancies on the federal bench than ever.
Right. I mean, do you think that this is why though Obama nominated Elena Kagan? I mean, do you think that he was worried about the polarizing escalation of this kind of nomination process? I mean, I guess what I'm saying then mm-hmm. is that if you don't think that Diane Wood would have engendered the kind of opposition among Republicans that would have led to a filibuster, I guess progressives are saying, why not nominate Diane
right.
Wood? Why not have that fight?
Well, I mean, I just think, I mean, to my best guess, is Barack Obama knows and likes Elena Kagan and what she stands for. You know, I mean, it's a little bit her record does not her record of writing sort of doesn't speak to the issues that I think most people care most about in these things. But she's obviously been cultivated very heavily by a series, of Democratic presidents. And is extremely well regarded by everyone who's ever worked with her. And I think mm-hmm. Barack Obama is, you know, genuinely enthusiastic about Elena Kagan. And, you know, so some people who are not that enthusiastic about Barack Obama's policies, I mean, that's on the right, but also on the left, you know, have reason to be suspicious of her.
Right, right. Now, another knock on Elena Kagan is from the right anyway, that they're making an issue of is her decision to ban military recruiters at Harvard Law School because of a disagreement that she had with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Right.
She was hardly alone in doing this. It led to a legal fight over the Solomon Amendment,
right.
which said that that to get federal funds, to qualify for federal funds,
right.
including, I presume, student aid funds,
right.
a university had to
let the recruiters on, and so then she
right.
was party to a lawsuit to try to get that held unconstitutional, which failed, right?
Right.
Quite solidly. Yep.
Right. Now, I do not have I do not have much to say about this issue, although if you wanted to, I don't know, Peter Beinart thinks that she should apologize. I don't know what you think about that.
No, I mean, I don't think she has anything to apologize for. You know, I mean, I think it was clear at the time that the lawsuit stage of this was a little bit on the frivolous side.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, what law schools are sort of, I think, maybe bound to litigate a little bit more than totally makes sense.
Right.
You know, but I mean, I think it was always clear that Congress had the authority to do that if they wanted to, which they clearly did. You know, I mean, and to be clear, I mean, military recruiters were not, quote unquote, banned from Harvard at any point. I mean, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I know people who joined the military. It was mm-hmm. not like mysterious, you know, how you find them or how one
right.
could sign up and join. I mean, there's a
right.
specific university-sponsored process. I mean, I assume it's different at the law school and at the college, but there's an Office of Career Services that has a set of employers that it works with. The military was excluded from that program, but it's not, you know, I mean, it's not like there were, I don't know, like hippie goon squads, you know, shoving military recruiters out the door or something like that. I mean, the whole controversy is largely symbolic, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, mm-hmm. on the left, a, you know, symbolic display of support for gay and lesbian equality and opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and on the right, you know, a symbolic display of support for the military as an institution. But, you know, I think not a controversy that had a whole lot of concrete impact on students' lives, on the American military, or that tells us anything we don't know about Democratic Party judicial appointees, which is that they are more sympathetic than conservative ones to gay rights claims.
Right, right. Well, I think that what it does is kind of put the military on the same footing as other employers, and I think that is probably not an apt way to think about the military as an institution. But, you know, whatever, you're right. It was a symbolic move. It was done as a gesture. It was litigated and it did not work. And it will probably come up. But I'm going to, you know, taking a cue from the veteran, use this as a segue.
Sure.
For student aid policy in general.
Ah, student loans.
Because as this, episode... That's right. As this episode demonstrates, the federal control over the purse strings for you know, most students' tuition gives them an inordinate amount of control over the way that universities can behave. And in this case, it's a minor thing. I mean, I doubt that you know, you or anyone who supports us. Tuition subsidies would say that, you know, well, this this fact that the government was able to come in with a Solomon Amendment and tie it to that is, it hardly offsets the benefit of subsidizing tuition or whatnot. But it is an issue that where, you know, the more power that you give the federal government over subsidization of something, the more power it can assert on a regulatory basis. And so this gets back to the, you know, the bill that passed
sure.
as part of the healthcare reconciliation
right.
that transferred the control over student lending from a subsidized private activity to the federal government.
Right.
I wrote quite a bit on this subject. You and others responded that my position didn't really make sense because as a conservative, I should be supporting the move that cuts the deficit. And according to the CBO, transitioning from private subsidized student lending to federal direct lending reduces the deficit.
Exactly.
I thought about maybe a different way to explain this that might be more clear.
Sure.
If you imagine student loan policy on a continuum, on a linear continuum with, you know, a fully private market for
okay.
higher ed financing on one end and total federal control of the activity on the other, and our current policy was somewhere in the middle, I would not support moving in the opposite direction from where I wanted to go, even if it reduced the deficit, because it gives the federal government more power over this activity. And as an example, I would point to the provision in the Student Aid and Fiscal Responsibility Act
right.
by which there is greater loan forgiveness for students that go into public office now, or public service,
mm-hmm.
not public office. And I don't see why we need to have that subsidy. I think that public employees on a median basis are compensated above their
well, okay, but so let's move back to the
okay.
loan policy.
All right,
and
all
I mean,
right.
I think this is the question is why do you conceptualize the continuum in that way at all, right? I mean, another way of putting at it is we have a continuum, you know, a cost continuum, right? And so you might say, well, you know, in an ideal world, we would spend no money on subsidizing college tuition.
Right.
But direct lending lets us do it with, you know, so much money, whereas subsidizing the private sector to do it costs even more money. Right. So why is it bad to sort of move to the cheaper option? I mean, in terms of government control, I mean, the issue here is, I mean, what difference does it really make? I mean, insofar as the student lenders are relying on federal guarantees and colleges mm-hmm. are relying on the ability for their students to get these federally guaranteed loans, the same ability to sort of make the student aid conditional on various things still exists, right? I mean, whether you like this public service thing or not, they could have written that as a freestanding deal without changing the structure of student loans and would have had the exact same impact.
I'm not totally sure that they could because under the previous regime, it was actually already the case, I believe, that students who took the I believe it's the Franklin loans, the federal direct
mm-hmm.
loans, could qualify for the loan forgiveness. Either that or, I mean, it was in the original legislation, it was written that this only applied to federal direct
sure,
loans.
Sure, sure. I just
and
mean,
so,
there was no barrier to Congress. I mean, if your concern is just sort of meddling, right? I mean,
right.
The existence of the subsidy creates the opportunity for the meddling just as much as the direct spending does.
It does. It does. But I think there is a different degree when you transition to the direct federal control over the activity. One reason is that under the old program, you know, the guarantee only applied to 97% of the loan. Now, that's admittedly huge, but when you talk about the scale of the program, that 3% cumulatively does mean that the private student lenders had skin in the game, and so mm-hmm. they did have a say over issues such as loan forgiveness, because if you're writing off the principal, they're losing money on that deal.
But I'm actually getting a little interested though in your dystopian ideal outcome in which we just have no tuition support at all. I mean, how thoroughgoing are you about that? What's the deal with all these subsidized like high schools everyone's going to across
right.
America? I mean, you know, I mean, I think like one concern people like me have about you know, when conservatives talk about school vouchers, say, right, is that
right.
You know, is that there's actually no endpoint to the kind of conservative hostility to a government program that'll exist there, you know. And
well,
that,
I disagree. Look the mm-hmm. thing about vouchers, though, is that we're still saying that you have to, you know, send your kids to school to a certain point. I mean, we're
right.
still considering a basic education as an
right.
externality that we are willing to, if perhaps we don't like the way that it's funded now. Under a voucher system, people would still be forced to, you know, they would still be forced to spend that money on education.
Right.
Right. I mean, we're, but what I'm saying
is. But I mean, I'm just talking
in
your ideal world, though, right?
Pushes,
like, I mean,
right,
is having like this government subsidized high school education, like, is that a huge mistake? Should we just.
No, I disagree.
Zero?
That's what I just said.
Okay.
I mean, I just said that I think that up to a certain level. Right. It makes sense to treat education as an externality and make sure that everybody has a basic one.
Okay.
Beyond that, though, higher education, it's already been demonstrated that our subsidy for this activity has pushed it beyond its usefulness. Right now, I believe something like 29% of Americans have a BA, something like 25% of occupations require a BA. So the whole system of traditional higher education, I think, is something that conservatives question the usefulness. I mean, you know, we have long explications of this idea by Charles Murray, which is that
right.
the BA
okay, but,
is something
I mean,
that is very
but,
limited usefulness, mm-hmm. and that if we had certification programs or trade schools or other kinds of forms of higher education, that it would be it would create a more flexible workforce.
But
and
so,
it would be better,
but so what,
better
I mean,
overall.
What about? I mean, there's considerable research. I mean, that I recall. Greg Mankiw has written about, you know, extensively to cite a conservative source, you know, and did too when he was working in the Bush administration, that one of the main drivers of sort of growing inequality over the past generation has been that the growth in educational attainment has not kept pace with what we saw in the past. You know, there's been a rising wage premium for college graduates. And, you know, Lawrence Katz and Claudia Golden point out in their book that, you know, traditionally what's happened in the United States is that each generation has been sort of better educated than the one that came before it. And that we are now, that since the early 70s, that process has stopped. And that's been associated with a slowdown in productivity growth, an increase in the level of inequality. And so on and so forth. So, I mean, I find this idea that it would actually be totally unobjectionable, you know, if we just people could not afford to go to college seems a little bit strange. I mean, that's a big conclusion to bootstrap just to get support for cutting student loans.
Yeah, I understand. And so, I mean, I would make a couple of points in response. Mm-hmm. And one would be that I thought I could be mistaken, but I thought that one of the things that Cass and Golden pointed to, although it's not something that negated their analysis, but it's something that Jim Manzi and others have brought up mm-hmm. as a sort of, you know, that something that maybe throws their hypothesis into question is mm-hmm. that we reached the limits of educational attainment because we had such high percentages of people, particularly completing high school, and where we saw, you know, one of the biggest increases in the wage premium that education confers was between not finishing high school and finishing
right.
high school, and now we have something, you know, something very high where we've reached the limits of what. I guess the point is that, you know, not everybody is right for this traditional form of higher education, this traditional college career path, and that the subsidies, the subsidized tuition regime has encouraged this traditional higher ed path. We're seeing we're seeing now that the for-profit schools have proliferated and become very good at capturing tuition subsidies. That you know the administration is uncomfortable with that and trying to crack down on them as well. So that's one point. The other point I would make is that when you just you simply assume that if we remove the subsidies, you know, tuition would remain at or near the same level, which is something I completely disagree with. We have a very substantial body of research.
So you think the education providers are capturing the bulk of the subsidy, and that
in in the case of now, with the caveat that in-state tuition has not demonstrated that trend. Simply because it's capped. It's a form of price control that these states impose, and they say that you have to educate our students, you know, at a you know very low rate of
tuition. Okay, but wait. I'm trying to get a grasp on what you're saying here, though. I mean, the Obama administration and I believe you know most preceding administrations, the Bush administration included, has had. Increasing the number of people who, you know, complete college be, a policy objective that they have.
Right.
Certainly, I've never heard, George W. Bush, like, brag about the fact that more and more people were dropping out of college during his tenure. That was not, you know, considered a policy achievement. Now, I know Charles Murray dissents from that view and thinks we have too many people going to college. Is that also your position?
I guess I don't subscribe to Charles Murray's vision in every particular. I would probably call myself a fellow traveler.
Okay. It strikes me just that one, you know, I don't know, you sometimes have these situations occur in politics where, you know, you have this debate that's happening in Congress, which appears to be about one thing. But then there's a real argument, you know, maybe happening in magazines and on blogs and stuff, which is actually quite different.
Right.
You know, and so it strikes me that here, I mean, there's a fundamental disagreement between and it's something of a strange bedfellows alliance between people like Charles Murray and a lot of people affiliated with labor unions in the United States, which says that, you know, increasing educational attainment is at best worthless and at worst harmful. And then you have other people, you know, more centrist Democrats and also I think a lot of conservatives that have said most of the Bush economic team, David Brooks, et cetera, who see increasing educational attainment as really vital.
Right.
And I think, I mean, that's a more important question, ultimately, I think, than a sort of relatively narrow issue about, you know, how exactly do we operate student lending.
Right. And I understand. I think that argument is important, and I've engaged it on several instances. But with regard to that specific policy, I mean, you know, there was a couple of reasons that I was opposed to it, which I thought I laid out pretty clearly.
But well, I think I understand you better now, actually.
Right.
I mean, you know,
the other thing too that I did try to explain that. The accounting methods by which the savings were produced, which I understand that they did not, that recalculating them did not wipe out all the savings.
Right.
But the bill that was produced definitely spent all the savings that were estimated. And they, you know, spent them on things like Pell Grants that have been shown to have a dollar for dollar effect on tuition increases at private schools and public, out of state tuition. So, I mean,
it is definitely true that the savings were re-spent.
Right.
You know, which, I mean, I think was a fair point that critics of the bill raised, but at the same time, I mean, you know, Judd Gregg, say, who I heard complaining about this a lot, I mean, he could have written an amendment saying, well, we're going to make the change, but we're going to plow the savings into deficit reduction rather than Pell Grants. You know, the operational legislative position was trying to defend subsidies and then was coming up with with sort of objections to it. But you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I definitely understand. I understand how that looks from the other side, because they're like, wait a minute, why are conservatives defending these, like, this form of corporate welfare? But the point is that it's also the case. Put aside, because I understand that we were getting into the weeds a little bit about,
right,
like whether or not the government would have the same degree of control when, you know, whether or not the banks were subsidizing, I mean, were offering the loans. But it's also the case that, you know, you see this pattern over and over again, and it puts conservatives in a very difficult position, because it was not conservatives that created, you know, subsidized student lending.
Well, yes, it was.
You know, I mean, I believe it was created, you know, on a bipartisan basis. But I, you know, the conservative position would have been, and probably should have been at the time, that the government shouldn't be setting interest rates and guaranteeing loans for college. But once they did that, is that arrangement preferable? Does it leave the door open for going back in the direction that conservatives want to go? I think it does. Whereas I think turning over the entire operation to the federal government, you know, all of that private infrastructure disappears.
Right.
It's not the case that we can go back in the directions that conservatives want to go in that point, at that point, and that's one of the reasons that we oppose it. I mean,
I guess this is what I'll say. You look at that argument, and you know, okay, it's not nonsense. You know, I can see what you're trying to say. But it strikes me also as pretty contestable. You know, just the question of from within the conservative worldview, you know, is this a step forward? Is it a step back? And it's striking, just to, as an observer of the scene and the way things
right.
go, that all the conservatives who were writing about this issue in conservative venues or talking about it on the radio or talking about it on television all came down unanimously on this position that, you know,
it was
happened
takeover,
to be the position.
A federal takeover of the student.
You, well, you know, and it didn't become, I mean, sometimes questions arise, right? Like, we were just talking about what's not a political hot button. Like, is it good for more people to go to college or not?
Right.
And as long as that is not a political hot button, you know, I don't know, all kinds of people think all kinds of things. It ties into their broader ideological point of view, but isn't determined by it, so on and so forth. And I feel like you might have seen something similar if we just brought up some question about direct student lending in, 2004.
But
instead, you know, it becomes an issue before Congress. The banks, who don't want to lose their subsidies, mobilize against it. And suddenly lots of people who hadn't been, like, out there calling for cutbacks in student loans of any form, or had never previously evinced, any real interest in this subject, all of a sudden, you know, are kind of out there pounding the pavement. And, you know, I mean, it shows, I just think the sort of the wide ambit that interest group politics, refracted through partisanship, kind of have on our dialogue, which maybe to make a transition, I think you see, like, so with Chris Dodd's regulatory bill, like, now all kinds of people have all kinds of opinions about all kinds of subjects that I'm sure most of them, or say me, like, had never thought of, you know, 18 months ago, mm-hmm. right? Like,
right.
I didn't, like, become interested in politics because I was passionate about derivative broker-dealer regulations.
Right.
And yet, I mean, it's amazing that the speed with which everyone can come to develop these relatively hard and fast opinions on it.
Right. Yeah.
Unless your opinions are weak and murky.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, well, it's something that we've been looking at for a while now. It's definitely the case that conservatives are still very, very divided on this. I mean, this is a case where I'm not sure that we would probably disagree on some things that have become more hot button, like the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, which I don't see a need for. But when it came to the bigger question of, do we need a better resolution authority for too big to fail firms? I've been making the case that we do for over a year now,
mm-hmm.
and so you know, that's not a position that a lot of conservatives have taken. You know, you have a lot of variety. Arnold Kling has said that, you know, banks are simply too big to be good from a political economy standpoint. We need to break them up. And you have other people like John Berlow of Competitive Enterprise Institute and Peter Wallison who have said we simply need a couple of tweaks to the bankruptcy code. And then we could resolve these firms through bankruptcy. And my view in defense of resolution authority is that it's simply not credible at this point for policymakers to say, you know, no more bailouts. We're going to let these firms go bankrupt. Not after what happened with Lehman and the fact that it solidified as conventional wisdom that retrospectively it was a mistake to let Lehman fail. I mean, everybody knows that that's the view that policymakers have taken.
Right.
And so they need a more credible option than bankruptcy to really restore market discipline to these firms.
I think that's exactly right. You know, and that it's foolish to think at this point that we can, with some kind of tweak, you know, close the door on that, and that you need to have, I mean, A, have something new, B, have it, you know, have a different name, et cetera, C, have it be that, you know, the policymakers who were responsible say, okay, you know, this is it, like, we set this up, it's a new process, like, we're going to use it, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, at least, that's the most important part of this bill. I mean, there's a lot of other things going on and a lot of stuff people talk about. But it strikes me that on that that sort of core element that we need a new resolution authority, that, you know, there's not universal agreement, but I think when people aren't sort of yelling at each other on cable, you know, pretty widespread agreement that this is important and that the bill, you know, does it, and then we need to pass something like that.
Right. Yeah. Now, there was the only place in this bill that Republicans were able to get traction was on the accusation that the resolution authority was not narrowly constrained enough to actually prevent policymakers from blinking like crazy in a game of chicken with these banks and actually, you know, bailing out the creditors, because that's the big problem, right? Is that some of these creditors are very geostrategically important people.
Right.
They're sovereign wealth funds and other people who lend to big banks, but they also lend to the U.S. government. And so, and so bailing them out might become a priority. Now, I mean, I've gone back and forth with other people on this because they saw that the Republican tactics as really just being politically motivated, that it was all drawn up by, you know, it was cooked up in a laboratory by Frank Luntz, the mad scientist, to come up with a way for Republicans to oppose this bill and score some points. I think the bill really did have that loophole. I think Tim Geithner and Sheila Bair really wanted it. And you can see why. I mean, if you were in the administration, and you were tasked with saving the world economy in the case of another collapse like this, you would want as much flexibility as possible. And I think Republicans did a good thing by saying that those loopholes needed to be closed. But I think a lot of people who hadn't been following it that closely, they didn't understand. You know, Chris Dodd was out there saying that this was not a bailout bill and you know, pointing to various provisions in the legislation that seemed to indicate that it wasn't. But in fact, if you carefully looked at the language, there were those loopholes.
I mean, you know, my understanding of this, which I will admit is not as good as it could be, is that this was essentially a cosmetic change that took place. I mean, that this critique was out there that Dodd and so forth, you know, felt that loophole had never existed, but that they were ultimately happy to, you know, to change the language in accord to what Shelby wanted. You know, I mean, the deeper issue, which a gentleman who is the president of the Minnesota Fed and whose exact name I can't recall, raised in a recent speech, is that, I mean, there's nothing Congress can do now to prevent Congress from changing the law in the future. I mean, if you look, if you look at, I mean, so bailouts has become a sort of vague term. But if you look at the two sort of biggest bailouts that were executed in 2008 and 2009 by the Bush administration and then by the Obama administration, neither the conservatorship of Fannie and Freddie nor the TARP were allowed under the pre-existing rules. What happened in both cases was that the Treasury Department went to Congress, said, we need you guys to pass a law or the sky is going to fall, and Congress passed the law. And in a slightly odd way, I mean, TARP became this hugely high-profile thing that, you know, everyone remembers, blah, 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 blah. But the law that passed months earlier that essentially authorized the Fannie and Freddie bailouts was – I mean, I'm sure it was controversial in the sense that someone wrote about it somewhere, but I mean, it was not, you know, it was the leaderships of both parties backed it. It hustled through on a bipartisan vote. It was like not on television. McCain and Obama did not debate it up there. And that has actually turned out to be by far, just in dollar terms, the costliest element of this. And yeah. I think it highlights the problem with any effort by Congress to create some kind of airtight anti-bailout mechanism, which is that,
right.
You know, if policymakers in the executive branch really feel that giving someone a bailout is vital to the global financial system, it's relatively easy for them to persuade Congress to give them whatever tools it is they ask for.
Well, it is, but, and again, I mean, I don't want to get down too, because we start to slice this very thinly and it starts to
Sure.
seem absurd. But at the same time, these things are important. And in with respect to these bailouts, the bill could have been better. And as you said, Dodd was not really averse to making these changes. But I mean, it's my view and the view of some others that just as a lot of liberals saw Republican opposition to the bill as being politically motivated, you know, it was also the case that forcing vote after vote when a compromise was actually doable. I'm talking about Reid, you know, repeatedly forcing the
right.
Republicans to filibuster the bill when they were trying to work on an agreement. It was clear at the beginning of the week that it,
right.
that the contours of, that the agreement would take. But it was still, I feel that the Democrats had found an issue on which they were winning, and they wanted to maximize their political advantage. I'll just explain very quickly, you know, how the bill changed and why it's not really a cosmetic change. One of the things was these that was in the bill was entrenching this ability of the FDIC in coordination with other federal policymakers to guarantee liabilities.
Right.
Right. We saw during the 2008-2009 bailouts, they guaranteed over $300 billion of Citigroup's liabilities alone. Right. So that's a fairly substantial potential liability for the taxpayer.
Right.
And the Dodd bill, as written, really put it on a fast track to approval. The president would have just simply had to request the authority to guarantee liabilities, pretty much uncapped. And unless Congress acted to specifically disapprove the request,
uh-huh.
it became law. And one change that Republicans insisted on, and that was made, is that rather than active approval, which is much more difficult for the simple reason that the president can veto a resolution of disapproval. And so, you know, you're talking about a supermajority rather than a simple up or down vote. So while you say that it's fairly easy to convince Congress that the sky is falling, that's true. It's unfortunately true. But don't forget that the first TARP vote in the House did actually fail. It's not,
right,
it's
but
not
I mean,
as easy to convince Congress to affirmatively approve something than it is to just say, you know, with the bar so high, with the presidential veto of disapproval, I mean,
my understanding is that you're wrong about the veto here. That, I mean, it was that the difference between the two ideas is that in the original proposal, Congress could sort of allow the guarantee to go forward by just not having the vote, so that then all the members could you know, still go home to their districts and like complain about bailouts. Whereas under the Republican language, the Congress actually has to take the vote. And so members can be held accountable for what they did, as opposed to sort of approving it by omission.
That's not the case. If in the original Dodd bill, there's specific language in that provision dealing with the case of a presidential veto. It goes through several pages dealing with the process, and the Republican amendment actually struck the word disapproval and replaced it with approval.
My bold, hypothesis here is that, Congress is going to approve whatever loan guarantees the Fed tells it.
I don't think you're going out on a limb with that.
Well, right.
I'll go ahead and agree. Yeah.
And, so this is why, to me, some of the more aggressive measures in terms of some kind of tax on large banks or some of these even bigger sticks as in breaking them up seem attractive. It's just that this bill strikes me as a very technically sound, effort to sort of resolve the situation, one that it's very unclear if it's actually going to hold up in the face of a real atmosphere of panic. What you have is, when there's panic in the financial markets, there's also panic in the political system. Almost by definition. You saw just the other day when the market went down by hundreds of points all the time. People are freaking out. And I think that, it's a lot better to have a good system in place for dealing with the panic than to not have it in place. But right. I think that what everyone still needs to worry about this new machinery they're setting up is that, if push comes to shove, it's not really going to be used.
Right. Particularly if the next crisis we face doesn't take the exact same contours. We're sort of regulating the last crisis in a very real sense, because when it comes time to deal with the next crisis, which I think the next crisis will likely involve some kind of repricing of sovereign debt in the wake of a major wave of defaults. And so that's going to affect the banking system, absolutely.
Right.
But it could actually take, we're just assuming that, the way that the new framework will be exploded is that the government will cave and will bail out the system again. But if the crisis is that the government itself is not able to do that, it's very hard to predict what will happen.
Yes, well, that's true. even in more prosaic sense, right? To an extent, what we've seen in this panic is just investors have been moving to what they view as the safety of government debts. At the same time, governments have been moving to take on more debt as the private sector deleverages. And you could easily imagine a situation in which, the reason people worry about Greece is that even though Greece is a small country and doesn't really matter, that,
right.
A single default by what's supposed to be a developed, first world country would call into question the soundness of a lot of other governments' debts,
right.
Directly, but would also expose a lot of potentially questionable decision making on the part of various financial institutions all around the world. The German politicians have made a good show out of pretending that they're being very generous to the Greeks in
right.
helping them out. But the reality is that the Greek government owes that money mostly back to German financial institutions. And relatively little of the world could actually afford some kind of cascade of defaults any more than they could afford a cascade of mortgage defaults, 2 years ago.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And so, I guess then that we could transition and talk very briefly. I don't know how much more time we have, but
this up pretty soon.
Right. Well, this fiscal commission that has been proposed to reduce the debt. Just to be real, very, very quickly, I don't know if you have a lot of confidence in this commission to come up with any you know, real solutions. I think, I think the only solutions to, you know, the problem of runaway entitlement spending and I guess as you would see it, too low a percentage of taxation as a percentage of GDP mm-hmm. would be, you know, a crisis of the kind that you described there, where investors are repricing, you know, all sovereign debt. And it really, you know, impedes the government's ability to borrow. I think that when you talk about, you know, political incentives, that's the, you know, being cut off with the having the credit card taken away is, I think, the only way that we're going to deal with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's correct. I mean, the U.S. political system has shown ability in 1982, in 1990, in 1994, you know, to respond to fiscal problems, but not just because, like, Pete Peterson shows on a chart that it might exist, but when it becomes like an actual problem where the political consequences for incumbents of not acting start looking mm-hmm. worse than the consequences mm-hmm. of acting. I mean, right now, you know, voters like say they're really upset about the deficit, but I mean, I don't think anyone in Washington thinks that a package of tax hikes and Medicare cuts is going to help you win re-election.
Right.
Now, faced with
except for Paul Ryan.
Yes. Well, he's gone for just the Medicare cuts. It's not, you know, it's not so hot as a political tactic. And so, I mean, it sounds dumb, I think, but you just sort of have to wait.
Yeah.
For like a real crisis. And, you know, hopefully work out some smart proposals, because what's likely to happen is that there will be action. It'll be quite dramatic and also mm-hmm. quite rushed.
Right. So you have to be. I think both sides have to ready their stocks of ammo and their cannons and their 5-point plans and be ready to spring forward with them faster than the other side.
Right, and that's what this commission is largely. I mean, that's what this commission and conservative criticism of the commission are both mm-hmm. largely about trying to position for some
right.
future time that conservatives don't want to put their names on paper saying that tax increases should be on the table, because they're, you know, they're trying to shape the ultimate structure of the bargaining situation.
Right.
Which, I mean, that's
right.
what I would do. I think even if I were a conservative, I might countenance some tax hikes in the end, but I certainly wouldn't say that in advance.
Right. Yeah, no, it's true. Jim Pethakoukas of U.S. News recently asked on Twitter, you know, how many conservatives would actually, you know, countenance a package of something like 25% tax hikes and 75% spending cuts. And I said that I would, you know, depending on the structure of the tax hikes. And he immediately warned me that I was going to be primaried. So
sure.
So that's
yeah, I mean, it's tricky. Yeah. All right. We've done 58 minutes. I think that's enough.
That's a good amount of time, Matt.
Okay.
Thanks so much for coming on and doing Blogging Heads.
Good talking to you.
And yes, and I will talk to you soon.
Great. Bye.
Bye.